This show is brought to you by SeatGeek, the perfect place to buy and sell tickets. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and we have a terrific show for you today. Detlef Schrempf, one of the pioneers of international basketball, the former Indiana Pacer, the former Seattle Supersonic, he is going to join us live. You can't miss that. That's next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Welcome back. The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. We are in Myrtle Beach, site of the Monday After the Masters tournament. And I'm pleased to be joined by one of the pioneers of international basketball, a 16-year NBA veteran, former All-Star, German Olympian, and now just an ordinary citizen, Detlef Schrempf. 16 years in the NBA, huh, Detlef?
Yep, 16 years.
2001 was your last year. When did you know it was over? When did you know that it was time to move on?
When my wife told me that she wasn't going to move again. No, you know, I felt pretty good, actually, at that age. You're hurt. I mean, that's part of the game at 38. But physically, I felt pretty good. I felt like I could have played a couple more years. But that last year was a little rough. And I figured it's time to go move on, do something else.
16 seasons, a long time.
Yeah.
Did you ever think that you'd have that type of career coming out of Washington?
No. I mean, I had no expectations. You know, I thought it was just a blessing to have a chance to play in the NBA, and struggled my first couple of years. I mean, I played, but, you know, coming out of college, you think you're going to be a star, and that didn't happen for me right away. So I thought about maybe I should go back to Europe and play over there. So I never expected, you know, 10, 12, 16 years. I just took it one year at a time, and it just happened to be, you know, a long time.
The favorite team that you played on, year, team, which one was it?
Well, it has to be Seattle. You know, it's home. We had a pretty good team. You know, we scared people. We played some interesting defense that was just, you know, all over the place, switching and overplaying, and scared a lot of people that way. And we won a lot of games. You know, for the five-year stretch, I think we averaged kind of like almost 60 games a year. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, everyone talks about how the Knicks got kind of screwed by Michael Jordan in the day, the Jazz. You know, they ran into Michael Jordan. You guys, as much as anybody, you know, ran into Jordan as well. You played the 72 win Bulls team, the quote best team for now in NBA history.
Yeah.
I mean, how good was that Bulls team you went up against in the finals in 96?
Oh, they were good. Obviously, the best record in the history, and so maybe next week, who knows? But they're really good. I thought we had a good matchup with them, and actually we played them pretty well, except you know, Rodman was the one that actually hurt us in the finals. You know, I think he averaged 18 rebounds or something, like 9 offensive rebounds against us. So, you know, for us it was the first time there. We didn't have the experience, but we thought we had a chance.
How crazy was that team? Because you had some personalities on that roster. You had some interesting guys.
Yeah, I think that was our best year, because prior to that we had some conflicting personalities, and even though we won a lot of games, it hurt us in the playoffs, you know, when it gets down and tight, and we had some issues with people. But I think that year and the year before, we really had a solid team. The next year too, that, you know, played together, and there was a lot of talking, a lot of stuff going on, but you know, from the coach on down, and but it worked.
It's one of the more remarkable coach-team relationships, because people that watch the NBA today see how combative George Karl can be. Like, he's not a, and I would assume you would agree, he's not a take any type of crap kind of guy. You know, he's going to give it back as well as he might take it. And you had Gary Payton there, who I would imagine was kind of the same way, that he was going to give it as well as he was going to take it.
Yeah, I mean, I think George was really easy to play for. You know, he wanted you to play hard, practice hard. He didn't really care if you missed shots, as long as you played hard. And I think that really fit our personality. You know, we just went at it. And, you know, some games we didn't have it offensively, but, you know, we kind of played aggressively and played defense and ran and kept going at people. But, yeah, you know, he He tried to instill that us against everybody attitude. You know, he thought, he always said, the media is against us, nobody likes us. And I go, I think people like us. Yeah, but that was George. And he got guys to play hard for him.
Who did that work best for, like that us against the world? Who on that team kind of fed off that as much as anyone?
Oh, probably Gary, for sure. You know, Gary had his issues with the reporters, with outside people, with other teams. But all of us, you know, it was a different time in the NBA. You were not friends with other players from other teams. You know, there was no hugging and kissing and all that stuff. It was different times. So we always, you know, we looked at other guys who were kind of our enemies.
Gary was one of those few guys that seemed like he just had the ability to do whatever he wanted off the court and still just turn it on when he got on the court.
Yeah, he played hard. You know, Gary and I had our differences, and we argued and we fought, and because, you know, he didn't like to practice. He'd sit on the practice on the sideline, and he'd moderate the practice, you know. And so I always said, shut up or get in here and play. And half the time, you know, after we kept arguing about it, he just said, you know, he'd get his sneakers and come play the second half of practice, because we kept, you know, flipping him a lot of crap because he was sitting there mouthing off. But that's how we were as a team. You know, we're pretty competitive, and it worked for us.
What made all that work? Sometimes when you have that many personalities, and you said the year before it, you know, cost you maybe something in the playoffs. What made that particular team work so well, given all the personalities that they had?
Well, because we had some veterans. You know, you talk about Sam Perkins and Hersey Hawkins and Nate McMillan, myself, you know, getting older. We could, you know, work with the guys that maybe had those personalities, and we took that into account. And George was one of them. George had that personality where, you know, he flip-flopped and, you know, went crazy and stuff. So I think we had a pretty good nucleus of guys that kind of were there for the right reasons.
What's something that George flip-flopped on for an example of that?
I think George is always paranoid that everyone hates you.
I think he still is.
The media is against you. The owner's trying to fire you. You know, it's always something like that.
That's exactly what's happening in Sacramento right now.
Yeah, well, that's another story. You know, you can't go out in the paper and say that kind of stuff, you know.
You feel for George in that sense there?
Oh, yeah, that's totally unprofessional. Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah, that's so wrong. That's why they are what they are.
Yeah, I think for any... If you're going to be on a winning team, you've got to have great ownership and great management on down. You can talk about coaches and players, but if you don't have that, you can't name a successful team that didn't have ownership and management first before anything else.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah. How often do you talk to George?
You know, usually in the summertime, to see if he wants to come to my charity tournament or, you know, how he is health-wise, but not that much anymore. You know, he's obviously... Well, he's almost done, so he'll be on vacation soon.
It's almost over. Yeah. Mercifully, it's almost over in Sacramento. You mentioned you came out of college. When you came out of Washington, what did you think your NBA career was going to be like? Did you think you were going to step in and, I'm going to be an all-star, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that?
You know, I don't know. I mean, you think back, first, I didn't have any money in college, so I didn't have... Back then, cable TV was just starting out, so you could only watch a game here and there, right? We used to sneak into the kingdom. I think my rookie year was the first year of where we were playing the Coliseum. So we didn't play in the Kingdom, but I remember sneaking into the Kingdom to watch games. So I had no expectations. I mean, I thought I was, you know, an All-American. I was going to go in the NBA and be a star, right? But I didn't know. I didn't really ever see all the NBA players play. So I didn't know.
When did the NBA become a dream for you? Because growing up in Germany, you moved before your senior year, right?
Yeah.
Of high school. When did the NBA start to pop on your radar? Because you came up pre-Dream Team and pre when it seemed like it really exploded on the European scene.
Not till college, probably my third year when we won our league and did well. And I was kind of like, whatever, second or third team All-American. And I was kind of go, well, I guess I don't have to go back to Europe. I might try this NBA thing.
Do you think that you would have gone to an American college, tried to get to the NBA if you didn't move for that senior year?
You know, I don't know. I have no idea. My whole goal was to play in the first league in Germany, so that's because that would pay for your schooling. And I was going to go to the university. So I had no expectations. you know, I didn't really realize at that time that, hey, you know, you can actually make a pretty good living in Europe playing, you know, in Italy or Spain or some other, you know, country. Germany was kind of semi-pro at the time, but it paid enough to pay for your education. So I didn't really have any plan to come here and stay. It just happened. I came 1 year for high school, and all of a sudden, you know, I had a one state championship and MVP and all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden people go, well, hey, maybe we should recruit him. And that's kind of how it worked out. I said, well, let me see if college works or play, you know, stay for a couple of years and then figure it out.
So you get to the NBA mid-1980s. A culture shock when you get there? I mean, what was your early memories of that first year? You played for Dallas.
Yeah, I went to Dallas. Yeah, it was different, you know, because, and I love Dallas. I love Texas. But, you know, we're in the 80s and we are young. We're from the Northwest. And there were a little different culture, different principles. You know, I always say that was the 80s was the, you know, big oil, big hair and big, you know. And it was kind of that. It was a lot of show, which we weren't used to in Seattle. It was a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff like that. But like Dallas, I love going back now. It's a great city. But yeah, it took a while. And the team was different. It was, you know, a college team. You're so used to just being a unity and everyone kind of pulling together. And there it wasn't. You know, they had a lot of stuff going on in that team. And it was a good team. It was a very talented team. Mm-hmm. But they didn't quite see eye to eye with each other, you know, so that was interesting.
What's the drama you remember the most?
Oh, Dick Motter and Mark McGuire. I think there was a lot of hate there.
I can see that.
Yeah, so there was, every day was something going on. And then Roy Tarpley came in my second year, right, who was a great talent, obviously had a drug issue, and, you know, that derailed the franchise for a few years.
Yeah, people... they know the name Roy Tarpley, but I don't think people understand just how talented that guy was as a basketball player. I mean, the drugs completely derailed his career, as you said, but he was something, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was talented. You know, 6'11", and, you know, long. I mean, you talk about Rodman as far as rebounding. That's what Roy did. He was not athletic. I mean, he, you know, he could dunk, but he was not athletic. And he was a little, maybe even heavy. But he could keep that ball alive. He would just tiptoe and tip it and tip it and, you know, and get the rebounds. He was a great rebounder. And, you know, and he was just around the ball. He was pretty active.
Could you see, you know, as you're watching him come up, could you see the problems unfold with him early on? Did you know this guy's going to have some issues when you were around him those first couple of years?
No, I was not around him. So, you know, like I said, that team had some different stuff going on, and there were different kind of, you know, small groups that were doing their own thing. I did not know. I mean, I was oblivious to drugs. I had no idea that, you know, I realized that we stayed in L.A. in a hotel one time, and another team was with us, that it was, you know, in the hallways. But before that, I was oblivious to it, so I did not know. And, you know, guys back then, there were a few beers around the locker room. That was about it, you know. So, yeah, I did not know.
Hang on for just a second there, Detlef, because even though we're sitting here in just T-shirts and jeans, I want to tell you about my most recent suit-buying experience, and that was with Indochino. And if you want to be unique, if you want to look good, if you want to feel good, I'm telling you, this is a deal that I have for you. Get a one-of-a-kind, made-to-measure suit from Indochino. Indochino is reinventing men's fashion, and a made-to-measure suit is the best suit you'll ever own, so suit up. Customize the details you want, pick your lining, lapels, personal monogram, and much more. 14 unique measurements go into making a suit that fits you perfectly. You can't go wrong with the well-crafted 100% merino wool suit. Also, check out their made-to-measure dress shirts and men's accessories. Made-to-measure suits are now affordable and available to the masses thanks to Indochino. I have one. It looks great. It feels great. It's one of a kind. And man, it's all mine. It's way better than a generic off-the-rack suit. When you look good, you'll feel good, and you'll feel confident. So here's the deal. And there's a money-back guarantee, by the way. Today, my listeners get any premium suit for just $399. That's up to a 50% off at Indochino.com when entering Mannix at checkout. Plus shipping, absolutely free. There's no reason not to try your first custom-made suit with a deal this good, and a suit classic from their premium collection will look good, feel good, and last a long time. That's Indochino.com, promo code Mannix for any premium suit for just $399 and free shipping. Indochino, your look, your way. All right, we're back here with Detlef Schrempf. How many international players were around those first couple of years for you, not just in Dallas, but in general? Because there's only a handful, right? I mean, there wasn't...
Yeah, I mean, I was the only European. I had another German that got drafted with me, Uwe Blab. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he went back to Germany after a couple of years. But, yeah, I'm literally was the only one. I mean, like, you know, I was the first European player that made it, you know.
Yeah.
It's a long time ago.
Did that make it any more uncomfortable? I mean, how big an adjustment was that for you being that guy?
It wasn't. I mean, I went to college here, so right. I didn't really consider myself like I came from Europe, but a lot of other people did, a lot of players did, you know. So, you know, thinking back then, not what the league is now, which is international. Back then it was like any outsider that came into the league was kind of taking a job from a U.S. player.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting. And again, I was oblivious to it again, but I heard sometimes comments about, you know, European, whatever, this and that. And I go,
which is crazy when you consider what the NBA is now,
yeah,
and how executives scour Europe for any 18-year-old Tony Parker type talent who's lurking on the back end of somebody's bench.
Yeah, and I think it's a reflection of how poor our development program is here in the U.S. now. I think high school and AAU basketball has helped global basketball, has helped players from all over the world come to the U.S. because we've done such a poor job here internally with our kids. We have so many talented kids. I've seen it for all these years coming to the league with just not enough tools to succeed because they're not being taught that in high school and early on in college. And I think it's just because AAU basketball, I think it's the worst there is for our sport. You know, when you take a kid that's now in high school age here, you can't teach him anything. The high school coach can't work with him. And so they go to AAU basketball, and it's literally, you know, pick up ball. Whoever has the ball does something with the ball. In Europe, in Latin America, these kids actually can be taught because they don't have restrictions. So they practice twice a day. So they have fundamentals. They all can shoot. It doesn't matter if you're a 7-footer. You're going to be shooting. You can make free throws. So I think it's hurt our development here in the States for all the kids that want to make it and can't make it because they don't have the tools.
When you started playing in the NBA and you would go back to Germany or be around people from Germany, how much did the perception of you change in your home country?
Actually, I went back and just before December, and I met all the guys I played with in junior ball when I was 16. So we had a dinner, and they remember me coming back after the first 2-3 years, and my German was really bad, right? Because I was gone for like 11 months, and I would come back and I would be searching for words, and they were going, "God, you were just an idiot. We hated you because your German was bad, and you know, and you couldn't even speak your mother's language, and you know, all this stuff." And now I still go back, but now I've been here over 30 years, I got the same issue. Right? So they're looking at me like, "Really?" And I go, "Dude, I've lived there twice as long as I've lived in Germany." You know, so, but you know, Germany to me is, German basketball is like U.S. soccer. It's a tier 3 sport in Germany, right? So soccer might be probably a tier 3 sport here, right? You got, you know, football, basketball, baseball, you know. So, yeah, I was a pretty big name back then because, you know, I played in Olympics and, you know, they, German newspapers, they print what you make. So they go, "This guy's making more than the soccer stars," you know. So that's the only reason that people knew about it. But most people were going, "What is basketball?" You know. When I started, the German Federation had like 1.2 million members. And that's, you know, say I left in 1980. And now, 36 years later, they got 1.2 million members. It has had no growth. And that's the sad part, right? Because they had some really good players.
Yeah.
They had some pretty good success. They won, you know, European Championship. They've done pretty well. Dirk Nowitzki.
Well, yeah. You get two of the best international players in yourself and Dirk that that ever played. That's surprising to me that it hasn't expanded.
Soccer.
Is that when you say that?
No, it's not surprising.
It's not.
With it.
Even now, after all that's changed, especially with Dirk. I mean, Dirk. Yeah. You know, the last and the way that TV and social media has connected everybody, you would think that the impact of Dirk would be even more powerful.
No, it's not. It's just, it's all soccer. It's Germany has always been soccer. I don't think that will change at all. I grew up on soccer. I only went to basketball because I started growing too fast, right? So that's just, but it's all soccer. It's tough.
There was no three-point shot when you were at Washington. Yeah. So you get to the NBA where there is the three-point shot. Do you say right away, I'm going to become... Because you had a few early on, too, or a few good years. I think you were second once in the NBA in three-point shooting percentage, like 47 or 48% in one of those years in Indiana. Did you resolve that I'm going to be a three-point shooter, or did it just happen kind of naturally?
It just happened, you know, because I went to Dallas, and we had a really good shooting team, right? You talk about... Brad Davis, who was the point guard, and then Derek Harper took over for him. But, you know, Brad Davis was a gym rat, so we'd shoot every day. He was a great three-point shooter, so that's how I started shooting threes. Mm-hmm. And then I used it really as a weapon. I never wanted to shoot a three. I wanted to step on that line and look at the rim and have somebody come running at me so I can go to the basket, you know. And then I got to Indiana where we used the three-point shot as a weapon. Because we had Reggie Miller and Chuck Person, and then I could, you know,
two guys pretty good at shooting the three.
Yeah, there. And then I would play, you know, the four with Chuck if I didn't come in for Chuck, and then we spread the court, and that really allowed us to go to the basket. Mm. But I never shot many. I just used it as a kind of like decoy, right, as a weapon to draw the defender in.
Those were the years too in the 90s when the NBA kind of jerked around with where the 3-point line was.
Yeah,
right.
That was stupid. I don't think you change the rules because you want to make the game more attractive, you know, coach the game better, I think. But, you know, now what they're saying, they're going to make maybe think about a 4-point line.
Yeah, no, God, they can't.
I don't
they
get
can't.
It.
That would become, then it's like you the got, N1 tour. Or,
yeah, exactly. You got numbnuts shooting from everywhere, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it has become that. And you talked about AAU and how that's kind of changed the game, the fundamentals of the game. Now everyone comes up and, you know, instead of wanting to be a good mid-range jump shooter, I got to jack threes at a consistent rate.
Oh, I see it at the AU level. The kids, they're pulling NBA threes. And we're going, you don't get rewarded for shooting at 4 feet longer than high school. But it's just, you know, they want to show what they got. And they can't make a free throw, but they're jacking it up from there. So
hang in for just one more second there, Detlef. I want to tell our listeners about SeatGeek. And have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated, and they all try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. SeatGeek has taken all the work and hassle out of shopping for tickets. They pull all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time and never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will let you know if ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. Best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. Unlike StubHub, they show you the full price from start to finish and never try to trick you with huge fees on the checkout page. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the Settings tab, and then click Add a Promo Code. Enter promo code MANIX. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code MANIX today. All right, we're back here with Detlef Schrempf. And Detlef, Indiana seemed to really change your career. Dallas was one thing, then you go to Indiana. What changed for you when you got to the Pacers?
Well, opportunity, one. But, you know, actually I was in Dallas just before I got traded. They traded Mark McGuire before they traded me.
Yeah.
So I finally thought, oh, here's my opportunity, right? And so for 2 weeks I got to play, and then obviously I got traded too. But I thought Indianapolis was a good opportunity for me because, you know, they needed me. I was actually playing 30-plus minutes. And it was an up-style tempo, you know. I mean, I came from a team that I just played in the Western Conference Finals and got dismantled. because all the issues there, and got traded to Indianapolis, I think it was just after the All-Star break, and it was like minus 50 with a wind chill, but they were 11-24. Mm-hmm. And so I get there, and the guy's going, hey, well, we're going on a cruise, you know, April 24th, you want to go, right? I mean, the season was over.
Right.
And I'm going, we got to play like 34 more games or something, the season's over. So we actually did really well, but it was, you know, playing just, we just played up-tempo. We just ran and gunned it and pressured, and it was a fun way to finish a season that I kind of knew was over, but we just, you know, it allowed me to do what I do well, was rebound, push the ball, run, and, you know, shoot threes and penetrate and all those things, and I was allowed to do that.
What was your relationship like with a young Reggie Miller there?
Oh, we're great. We had Indianapolis was a really fun team because we're all about, you know, we're all young. At the time, we are kind of, I think all of us were like recently married. Reggie was, Chuck was, you know, so we're a really young group. We had Thanksgiving dinners together, Christmas parties, New Year's parties. It was a fun team. Mm-hmm. And we were young, you know, so we lost 2 years in a row to the Boston Celtics in the first round, but, you know, we were pretty young and dumb. and Reggie, you know, we worked out all summer together, you know, ran the track, all those things. So it was a very professional atmosphere for me.
Did Larry Brown coach you any of those years?
Larry Brown traded me.
Larry Brown, okay.
Yes.
Well, that's not, you shouldn't take offense to that because Larry tries to trade everybody.
No, I don't. I'm happy. He told me I had an all-star season, you know, and he came in and says, no job is safe. I'm not sure I'm going to start. You did really well as a sixth man. I go, wait a minute. I just like had an all-star season. I was, you know, averaged like almost 20, 10, and 6, and you're going to put me on the bench. And he goes, well, we'll see. And then I got traded a week later. Mm. So I was okay with it.
Yeah. Tough to take from that perspective because you had such success that previous year.
Oh, that's a long time ago. It is what it is. But I just remember that he said, wow. And I go, okay. But I got traded, and, you know, it could have been worse. I got traded back to Seattle, so which worked out great.
Yeah, what was going back to the Washington area, being in a more comfortable place? I mean, how much better was that? Was it better for you to be back in your kind of...
No, I loved Indiana. I think we had a great relationship with everyone there. The fans were great, and we were a young team. Both my boys were born there, and so we raised a family, starting a family there. But, you know, coming home was, it was different. You know, I was not the... You know, Reggie and I were at that point, were kind of the stars of the team. And I went to Seattle and kind of came in and, you know, going, okay, how do I fit in? We had a pretty crazy team, a lot of egos. And, so George asked me just kind of, you know, fit in where you can. And I got there a day before the first season game, you know, started and played, you know, 35 minutes the next day. And we won the first 10 games of the season.
Mm.
And part of it was, you know, I had no ego. I was just trying to figure out where I fit in, and it was fun. and you know, you play in Seattle, and we start that season. It was, you know, 17,000 sold out, you know, Key Arena, and rocking. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was great atmosphere to be back home.
I mean, now when you look back at all those Seattle years, great experience, good experience. How did you?
Yeah, I think it was great. We had a great fans. So it was a great atmosphere. We won a lot of games. Same thing, you know, I think we went through a cycle. I think it was unfortunate that they tore the team apart. You know, they traded Sean and probably sent Sean, you know, on a downward spiral, you know, because next time I saw him, he was 60 pounds heavier.
Yeah, Cleveland.
And so, you know, it was one of those things where they, you know, we had a very successful team that all got along, which is hard to do. I mean, the key elements, and they pulled it apart and, you know, and had to start from scratch again.
Yeah, that was the lockout that got Sean, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because he became kind of the poster boy for not being able to stay in shape for 3 or 4 months because he was big when he went to Cleveland that year.
Yeah.
How surprised were you to see that from a guy that was above the rim his entire young career?
Yeah, that was sad. And same thing happened with Vin Baker.
Yeah. Right?
They traded for them, and Vin Baker came in, and he was the same thing. He was overweight and... Yeah, all kinds of issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a shell of himself. And they had to rebuild.
Yeah. So, what did you think of Baker the years that you were with him?
Talented, but I think he had some demons he had to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you wind up going to Portland after that. That experience, a good one when you look back on it?
No.
No.
No. We had, you know, we, from a talent standpoint, we should have won the championship, and we were there. You know, we at the Lakers in 7, and we were up, whatever, 15 in the fourth and fell apart. But it was one of the most undisciplined teams I've ever been on with, you know, 7 All-Stars. It's, there was no direction. It was all talent, and it was disappointing, actually, for me. That's why I said I'm done.
Do you think if that team was more disciplined, more successful, you might have tried to stick around for a few more years?
I think if we had won it, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I went there to win a championship. And if it had been run the right way, you know, I think it could be a really good team because it was young. You know, we had a couple, 3 old guys, you know, Arvidas too, but, you know, we had Pippen came in and Steve Smith, Arvidas, and myself. But, you know, you had some young, talented players like Rashid, Bonzi, who was talented.
A little wacky.
Yeah, Jermaine O'Neal,
mm-hmm.
you know, Brian Grant. But there was just no direction. And so from that standpoint, I go, well, you know, you look back on that, I bet all those guys would say, we wish we had done it the right way.
Was it a bad mix of kind of players because you had – the veterans you just mentioned, plus the really young guys. I mean, where did you see the biggest problem with that team?
Well, direction, leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is surprising because it would seem that there'd be leaders, at least on paper, yeah, on that team. No.
No, it was surprising.
That was Scotty's last few years.
Yeah.
With that team, what was he like towards the end?
You know, Scotty had a great career. I think in Portland, they probably asked him to do too much to be, you know, leading a group of guys that were all over the place. You know, and I think it started from the top, from ownership to management and coaching, because with a team that talented, there had to be a better direction, and it wasn't. You know, when practice would be starting late every day, guys would leave as soon as practice is over. Nobody would stick around for shooting practices or anything like that. It's just it's a wrong atmosphere. It's a wrong culture.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, you know, you can win if you have enough talent, but when things go wrong, it's really hard to pull out games. And I think that's what was proven in the playoffs.
I mean, you've been around a long time to that point. How much did you try to talk to that group? And because you'd been to a finals, obviously you got other guys that have won championships as well.
Yeah.
With Scotty, I mean, how much did you try to?
Yeah, we did. You know, I always said he try to lead by example and do the right things. But you know, I was at fault too because I'd give. You know, I was just shaking my head. You know, so I'm not taking me out of the
sure.
equation. It was, there are a lot of things went were handled the wrong way, and you know, you can talk about it or you can address it. And as a 7th, 8th guy on the team, you might not have the power mm-hmm. that you did earlier. So you know, Joe Klein was there, and we would just be going, come on, guys. So they were looking at you, come on, you dorks, you know, looking at us, you know. So it's sad because I thought that team had another 2-3 good years together. But then again, you know, next year it totally cratered
yeah.
and dismantled it, right? They
yeah.
got rid of everybody, and that's what happens. And to me, that's what doesn't happen to good teams, right? San Antonio doesn't have that.
No.
Yeah.
No, they practice. They're disciplined every day, every practice, every game.
Exactly, from the top down. Yeah, so we didn't have that.
So did you feel like it was, I mean, ownership and management as much as it was
totally.
The guys on the roster? In what way was it ownership and management there?
Well, I think ownership always has to own up to the fact that they actually own the team. They make the calls, and it starts with management of, you know, the GM is, you know, overviewing what's happening and analyzing, and the coach ultimately has to make the decisions on that. And we had a lot of flare-ups. I mean, we had guys where, you know, they were guys fighting each other, threatening each other, throwing punches at the coach, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which, was it handled the right way or not?
Throwing punches at the coach? Who was that?
You would know.
Well, see, it's hard, though, Dedlif, because that team, you could yeah. Bonzi Wells, you could Rashid. There were yeah. some combustible personalities.
And then it'd be like, oh, we're going to give him a 1-game suspension. Yeah, Really?
I mean, and whose responsibility is it to clean that up? Is it the general manager's job in that position, yeah, or is it just fall on the coach?
No, probably. You know, I would think your coach has no power unless he's empowered by management.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was Mike.
Mike Dunleavy.
Good guy. I like Mike a lot. He had a crazy bunch.
Do you feel like he didn't get the support from from management that he – would it have been different, you think, if he did get that kind of support?
Well, I assume he didn't get the support
right,
because I think nothing happened on a lot of those things, right? Mm. So, and again, it wouldn't happen on a good team, right?
Right. Yeah. So when you retire, do you say, I'm done with the NBA? Do you think maybe coaching is for me? Managership is for me?
I coached a year. I like coaching. I like teaching. But I don't like the lifestyle. You know, I'm not going to go move to a different city every 2 years because mm-hmm. you get fired. I don't need that in my life.
It's a very nomadic existence there.
I don't need it. I wouldn't be able to come here and go.
Did you realize that after that first year, when you did some coaching, that you know, this?
No,
season?
I was. You know, I'm all in when I do stuff like that. I was all in, but then you know the Sonics sold, and I realized that they weren't going to stay in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
and they was not going to move to Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a great city, but I'm not moving. So I said, well, that's over with. So yeah, I didn't pursue that any longer.
If you could guarantee you'd stay in one spot, do you think you could have been coaching, or do you think you would have been somewhat frustrated by the players of today?
No. You know, I mean, I coached in a mediocre team, right? The Sonics were not making the playoffs. They're below average. So it was challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But I like teaching, and I enjoyed that part. But the organization was also at a point where they were cutting costs left and right because they were placing it to sell and they didn't want to spend any money. I mean, it was, you know, it's not the Sonics that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sad to see them really running it into the ground, you know. So, it's an interesting business.
How sad does it make you to see a team not in Seattle? Because they had a great fan base. You know, the facility, maybe you can... Yeah. Criticize things that were done by ownership, you can criticize, but the fan base there is strong.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you see it now, everyone's talking about this Seahawks 12, right? The 12s, because that was our sixth man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sonics had the sixth man, and you know, we were sold out every game. Every home game was sold out. It was crazy. It was the loudest arena in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a great following, and so from that standpoint, it's really sad that we don't have a team. You know, everyone's still hoping we get a team, but we are losing that generation where, you know, dads can take the kids to a game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they can go to a Husky game, but to see, you know, the best players in the world come through and people, you know, when your boy is watching LeBron or, you know, Kobe retiring or whatever, Durant, and you can't take him to a game. You got to drive to Portland or you got to go on the road. It's not the same because you're not cheering for those teams, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's... I think it's kind of sad that we don't have that because we had that for, you know, 40 plus years.
Mm. You see the players of today, Kobe, LeBron, Durant, playing a position that you played back in the day, the small forward spot. The best small forward you had to defend was who?
Oh, God. Anybody can get it. But, you know, I played from Bird to Dominique. You played Dominique, you knew the ball was going up 30 times. You know,
yeah.
And if he was hitting, he's going to give you 50. So there were a lot of Bernard King, early in my career, but later on, you know, James Worthy. I mean, there were so many great scorers on the small forward position, and they just didn't jack it up. They scored. They were, you know, most guys didn't take 25 shots a game.
Mm-hmm.
They post you up and they drive and they get to the free throw line. So it was tough. I mean, that guy said, busted me up that, you know, you kind of go, who's that, right? But, I think it was a great position. I love playing a small forward because you did everything from post up to shooting threes, penetrating, and putting out a lot of good guys.
You got any good memories of Bird, of trying to defend him, and over those years that you guys were overlapped?
Oh yeah, Larry. Larry talked, you know, but he was kind of precise in what he'd say. I remember we lost to them in the playoffs. I was in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And Chuck Person was still on our team, so I played the three and the four. And Chuck had a pretty good playoff series, but you know, Bird had a great playoff series. And then we played him Christmas, just before Christmas, maybe day before Christmas the following year, for the first game against him. And, you know, Chuck was taking it up from the playoffs, so he just started talking the whole game. And it was a very close game, and I remember I was on the bench at the time, and Larry catches the ball in front of our bench and takes a step back behind the three-point line, and Chuck is on him, and Chuck is, you know, talking to him, and Larry lets it fly and starts walking down on defense and says, "Merry Christmas, Chuck," and the ball goes in, right? And even all of us on the bench are laughing, right? Because Chuck is just talking and yelling at him, go, take it, you know? And, you know, it's one of those things where there was no cursing or anything. It was just, you know, precise.
Yeah. He did that a lot. That was his one of the more underrated talkers, I think, in NBA history.
That was pretty good.
And Dominique, your best experience playing against him?
Oh, Neek is scary stuff. You know, you dunk on the whole team. Yeah, Dominique was, he had to be ready. He would go hard for 48 minutes and shoot from anywhere. And when he was on, there was nothing he could do. I think he tip dunked on me one time where I was still trying to go up and a ball was already coming down, you know, but it's part of the game. So he was an amazing athlete.
You're an interesting guy to ask this because, you know, it seemed like the Dream Team changed the global landscape of basketball where people in Europe and other places started to pay more attention. From your perspective, what did the Dream Team do to European basketball, international basketball as a whole?
Well, I think it put things in perspective, right? Because I played in 84 in the Olympics and it was all amateurs. So that was kind of the college Dream Team with Jordan and Patrick Ewing, all those guys. And they won by a lot then. And we played them, actually, and I think we had a really close game. We lost, like, by 11 or so, I think. And so, but they killed everybody. I think they won by 30 on the pitch. But then, you know, there was pros weren't allowed, and there was a boycott. And then so it took till 92 till the real pros showed up, the Dream Team showed up, Barcelona. And an awareness for the rest of the world how good the NBA was. And I think the NBA had evolved a lot over those 8 years because, you know, it had some issues in the early 80s. But by 92, those guys played together. And they didn't even practice. You know, they just did what they did. And to see, you know, the difference of not just talent but size, you know, overall was quite impressive. And, you know, people were scared. And, you know, there were the stars, European stars are coming up and going there. They want to get an autograph, you know, after the game, you know, that kind of stuff, right? So I think it was huge for the NBA because it showed the world how good the NBA is.
Did you have teammates that were like that, wanting pictures or autographs?
Yeah, they were all scared. We were warming up before and literally the guys couldn't make layups. I go, guys, I'm going, listen, we're going to play hard, you know. Play well, you know, we're going to hang in there. But don't worry about it. Take your shot, you know, if you make it, great. And it was funny because we played and they guarded me with two guys. And I'm going, you know, Clyde Drexler was guarding me. And then they had, like, Malone behind me. And I go, what the hell, guys? We're going to lose by 30, right? And we lost by 30. So did everyone else. And those guys were, you know, we stayed in the village. It was hilarious because one night we had a day off and some of us went out to, like, grab pizza, right? And we stayed in little rooms, two to a room, and literally touching each other. And the rooms were no AC. It was 110 there. So the room was, like, you know, 100 degrees at night. You couldn't sleep. Mm-hmm. So we went out and got pizza and we walked by, I think it was the Ritz-Carlton, and Barclays coming out. The team is staying at the Ritz-Carlton. And we are like, you know, bunked up. And like, and they're just like going, oh, we're going gambling tonight, you know? And we're going, well, we can't sleep.
we are just out because we can't be in our rooms now.
We used to sit out at night in the Olympics because you couldn't be in a room till like 1 in the morning when finally cool air would come in and fans, we had fans going. And, you know, that guy stayed at the Ritz-Carlton getting room service.
when you played them in that game in 92, you're obviously familiar with a lot of those guys having been in the NBA like 6+ years, but how much talking did they do to you in that game? just out of familiarity, maybe.
Oh, no, we just talked. We said, oh, what's going on? How you guys doing? What are you up to? But there was no talking. The game was over after, you know, 8 minutes. It was a 15-point game right away, you know, so. No, there was
did you ask them to stop double teaming you when you're or triple teaming you?
Yeah, no, it was funny. Yeah, no, it's good times.
You mentioned you didn't want to get into coaching, or after the year of coaching, you didn't want to do it anymore. A general manager position, that kind of stuff, did that ever appeal to you?
At that point, I probably would have gotten into the management side more, but now I like what I do, and I'm not changing at my stage in my life, mm-hmm. you know. As far as taking that on, because, you know, it's first of all, we don't have a team.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're 5 years away from getting a team, if we're lucky.
Mm-hmm. Do you take pride in kind of being one of the pioneers of European basketball? I mean, it was 6-7 years before it exploded the way it did post-Dream Team. I mean, how much pride do you take in your own legacy, which is being one of the first? if people could see he's shrugging his shoulders here, well, you know.
I do, but it's, you know, it's not going to define me.
Right.
And, you know, I was had people saying here earlier, they said, hey, well, why are they not in the Hall of Fame? You know, all these other European players are in the Hall of Fame. And I go, I had a good career, you know. I mean, if I was an American player, I wouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. So you're going to consider me for a Hall of Fame because I'm the first European?
You know? Well, I think there's an argument to that. I'm not trying to blow smoke here to you, but you know, Yao Ming is going in the Hall of Fame. And Yao is going in the Hall of Fame, I think, in part because he opened up the Asian market to NBA players. And you certainly helped do that in a different way with the European market.
But that's good. My, you know, if it happens, great, but it's not going to matter to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
They go, what is that?
Would that make you a bigger star in Germany? Or would they still say, why didn't you play soccer?
Yeah, exactly. So, no, it's, I think I take pride in it. I take pride in my German heritage because mm-hmm. I think that helped me become who I became as a player, you know, because you're just, you know, focused and determined, process-oriented, and you go to work. But I hope I paved the way for other guys so that it was easier for them. And now it's become a global sport. And I think that's what the world is coming to anyway. It's not just in basketball. You know, it's global. It's diverse, multinational, and I think it's fun. You know, and when you look at the good teams, a lot of the good teams, they have international players that have created a really unique culture. It's about winning and playing together and being teammates, and it's not about your own stats.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you look at San Antonio as a prime example. You know, those guys don't care about their own stats; mm-hmm. So they care about, you know, doing well together. And if you can duplicate that, you usually have a winner.
What did you think about how when the USA and the world, the gap closed for a little while there? Was it 2002, then 2004, which was I think a bronze medal year for the US? It's now expanded back again. But when you watched what was happening there, because that was right at the end of your playing career. What mm-hmm. did you think of how the world closed the gap that quickly?
Well, first of all, the guys, top players didn't want to play, right? I mean, when you look at the teams that the U.S. sent, it wasn't the best players. And I think the coaching has a huge thing to do with that. You're mm-hmm. taking superstars. And, you know, that's why I think Krzyzewski is, like, unbelievable what he's done with egos. And, you know, you can send a bunch of all-stars, doesn't mean you're going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what has happened is that the U.S. realized that, hey, shoot, the world has gotten better. We can't just send anybody, and we got to have a team that's actually managed properly by a great coach mm-hmm. To succeed.
There still was, though, I would say, a pretty significant talent gap, even with the teams that the U.S. sent there.
Yeah.
Was it just that they were disjointed, maybe didn't have the same passion? Because I think that's defined the current USA basketball program. They all care.
Yeah.
You know, they're all invested in it from whether it was LeBron, now it's Durant, Anthony Davis, and whatnot. You feel like maybe they didn't care enough back in 02 and 04 the way they do now?
I don't know what it was. It looked that way. Mm-hmm. It looked like there wasn't, you know, well, just another game. No, it's you're representing the United States of America. You know, the other teams are playing for their country. And I think for our guys at that point, it was more like it's just another tournament, right? But I think that has been conveyed properly over the years now because it's a big thing. But it's also getting so much more attention. You know, 02, 04, people remember? Mm-hmm. Did anybody watch it?
I think they remember only because it was in the U.S. Yeah. in 02. Yeah. In Indianapolis when it was like sixth place in that. That was rough.
Yeah.
That was rough to watch on U.S. soil there.
Yeah. No, it's a big thing to the rest of the world. To us, it's never been a big thing until maybe the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at Russia, Soviet Union, you know, before that, and, you know, Yugoslavia now, you know, with Serbia, whatever you want, you know, it was their big tournament, the Olympics, the World Championship. It was, you know, and the U.S. was like, it's nothing. We got, you know, the NBA championship. That's what it is, right?
Mm-hmm. So now you've got your budding acting career, obviously. Parks and Rec.
My phone is not ringing.
How did you get involved with that show?
They literally just did a search. You know, plays in Indiana.
Right.
Supposedly played in Indiana. And they did a telethon. The first show was a telethon. So they wanted a pacer that has charitable interests.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they just did a search and came up that I had a foundation. And they said, hey, you want to come do this show with us? And I looked at it and go, I like one line, you know, presenting a check or something. Mm-hmm. I go, okay, I'll do it as long as you at least mention my foundation. I try to get something out of it, you know. And then the check should say from Detlef Schrempf Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it started out. And Amy Poehler said Detlef Schrempf Foundation twice, and she actually pronounced it fairly good. But that was it. And then I got there, and they kept adding stuff. You know, they said, oh, it'd be so funny if we, you know, if you're in the back of the car with your knees next to your ears, and then you go have a drink at this club, and, you know, and that's how it started. So then that was the final episode of the first season. They were kind of going, we don't know if we're going to be here next year. We've got to get picked up. And so next year they got picked up, and they had a successful year. So they go, let's do it again, final season. And then the third year, they brought on Roy Hibbert also from Indiana. So and after that, I never got a call back.
Yeah, but see, like my producer Adam here, I think he knows you best from Parks and Rec as opposed to your playing career now.
No, I got kids. You know, it used to be I had somebody young come up and they go, hey, I know you're like a hostess at a restaurant. I know you. And I go, here you go. She was going to say, yeah, I used to sit on my daddy's lap when I watched you play basketball. You know, yeah. And she goes, you're on Park and Rec. You know, I go, really? I had like 3 10-second, you know, stints. But it was funny. It's a funny show.
And Hollywood hasn't come a calling since.
No, yeah, my talent is, you know, I could play next to Arnold Schwarzenegger, but that's about it.
But you know, you've got your foundation, which is something you obviously take a lot of pride in.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been going strong. I mean, Darius actually performed there last year. Mm-hmm. So he came out and put on a hell of a show. Had a great gala and golf tournament. So we raised over, I think, $1.3 million last year. So we got ours coming up in 2 months, our 23rd year.
Wow. And is that what you're most involved with full-time now?
No, I work full-time for a wealth management firm.
Right.
So I work in the office, traveling. Yeah, that's what I do.
Yeah. Enjoying that part of life?
I enjoy, I don't manage money, don't ever want to. I hand it mine off. I enjoy meeting people and solving issues.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to help a lot of folks with planning, figuring out, you know, where they want to go, what the future holds. So I enjoy that part. Yeah.
Do you, I don't know if you do this or not, or if you would aspire to do or not, but I mean, today's NBA with the money these guys have and how quickly it goes out the door, would you ever want to get involved with, you know, helping players save long term? I know they're, I mean, the owners of Milwaukee Bucks have done that with their guys, sort of taking them out and trying to show them how to.
We work with some athletes. I speak at the NBA rookie orientation every year about that. But I also have some guidelines, kind of rules of taking guys in. And they're very simple, but a lot of guys can't get past that hurdle. And the first one is separate your money from your agent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think your agent is there to give you a great contract and do whatever marketing deals you can do. He didn't go to school to manage your finances.
Mm-hmm.
So he should never have power of attorney over your accounts and be able to write checks out of your accounts. That's how it starts out.
Mm-hmm.
And most guys do. So, and then it goes from there, right? But no, it's sad because I think we've created this huge industry of professional athletes making so much money. And for them, a lot of them, you know, 60%+ of pro basketball and football guys are broke after their career, 3-4 years in after their career.
That's amazing.
You know, and we're talking about not guys 20 years ago, guys that are made $50, $60, $100 million.
Mm-hmm.
That is amazing, and it shouldn't happen. And, you know, mismanagement, lifestyle, fraud, everything is part of it, right? Mm-hmm. So you can take some simple steps to eliminate some of those, right?
Mm-hmm. So it's got to be hard telling a 19, 20, because that's how young these guys are. But you went 4 years at Washington. Most of these guys are 1 year at wherever before they come out.
Yeah, and I can't say I can relate. You know, we had two kids leave the University of Washington, right, after 1 year going pro. They'd be first rounders. You know, so how do you tell a kid that's 19 that he's going to get 4 years, $12 to $15 million guaranteed and not take it? And the parents, you know, are living the central district, don't have any money. So it's hard. But you got to, I think, got to put some guidelines in there, because otherwise you'll be back there in a few years. Right. And, but I can't relate to it. I never had any money coming here to college, so I scrapped by until I made the pros, and I didn't make millions to start out with. So it's a little different.
Do you ever wish you were born like 20 years later?
No, I probably would have blown my first check on a Ferrari and something crazy.
Yeah, but the checks would have kept coming. I mean, the way this summer is going to shake out,
yeah,
I mean,
or
no, in 2017
nuts.
And 18, when that salary cap spikes, man, there are going to be some Monopoly money thrown around.
Yeah, but, you know, you can say the same thing with guys that played 20 years before me, right?
Mm.
Oh, look at those guys.
Yeah.
You know, look at Magic Johnson, signed a 10-year, $15 million contract. I think, remember that first one that was big, where, you know, that was the biggest contract.
Mm.
That's a one-year deal now, right? Maybe a decent one-year deal.
Did you ever have teammates early on that had other jobs? But I mean, it probably wasn't at that point where you made more than enough money to...
Yeah.
But nobody did work on the side doing anything else.
Guys were making millions.
Even, but I'm even thinking like the back end of the bench guys or...
No,
or
but so. I think the minimum... Yeah, I don't know what the minimum is now, over a million, but it used to be like, you know, 500, 600.
Yeah. More than enough. You can get by on 500, 600.
If not, probably a lot of guys didn't, because they tried to live up to the, you know, the star of the team driving a, you know, $250,000 car.
Yeah. Well, Detlef, I really appreciate it.
Yeah,
this has been
you.
Fantastic. Congratulations on all your success, both in your career and post. Thanks for joining on the podcast here.
I appreciate it, and have fun tomorrow.
Thank you. Appreciate
all right.
it. All right, that's it for this week's Vertical Podcast. Make sure you check out all the Vertical Podcasts with JJ Redick, with Adrian Wojnarowski, and with myself, of course, on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. And we'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.